You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. In July, Netflix finally dropped the first six episodes of the eagerly awaited reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, and episode 5, The Berkshire UFO, brought a little-known UFO incident to worldwide attention, the 1969 Sheffield UFO case. I was struck by the sincerity of most of the witnesses in the episode, especially one man, Tom Reed. As most people discovered, Tom and his family had an experience that changed their lives. Incredibly, they were not alone, and Tom has spent the next 50 years trying to find answers to what happened that night. I'm delighted to be joined this week by Tom, and also Judge Kevin Titus, to discuss just what the episode didn't include: the battle over his UFO monument, the other strange incidents that have been occurring over Sheffield in Massachusetts, the unusual military connection to the area, and other interesting facts. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and a big thank you to Tom and Judge Kevin for joining me on this week's show. It's a case that really has got people talking, so it's great to see that this case is finally getting some long overdue attention. Before that, don't forget you can support us on Patreon by clicking on the link in this week's show notes. You can also subscribe to our channel on YouTube, and we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This week's artwork, once again, by my wonderful brother, Dean Bestall, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. So let's join Tom and Judge Titus to dive into the Sheffield UFO incident and find out much more than we were shown on Unsolved Mysteries. In July, Netflix ushered in the eagerly anticipated reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, and of the six episodes, one caught the attention of many: the Berkshire UFO incident. Outside of the UFO research community, this case was unknown to many, but for those with an interest, this was a long overdue look at one of the most compelling cases of its kind. To discuss this case and much more, I am delighted to welcome Tom Reed and Kevin Titus to Mysteries and Monsters. Gentlemen, welcome, and thank you for joining me this evening.
Oh, thanks for having us, friend.
So, I can only imagine how mad life must have been these last couple of months, Tom. With the greatest respect, I know you are no stranger to interviews and dealing with the media. Have you been amazed at the interest that's come your way since this case debuted back at the beginning of July on Netflix?
Yeah, to a large degree, sure. To my surprise, actually helped in many ways in New England and in the Berkshires where this case took place, because even though we've, I guess, been the subject of a half dozen TV documentaries or what have you in the past, they're either Discovery Channel and it's run maybe once or twice a year, and like Ancient Aliens, you know, you have to kind of wait until that episode runs again. Mm. Whereas this being Netflix, you can rewatch it and repeatedly, and for that alone, so many more people have become aware of this case in a way that I couldn't have imagined. To my, surprise, again, that, you know, the documents weren't shown in this episode, and they actually were supposed to be. We were actually promised that those documents from the governor, lieutenant governor of the state of Massachusetts, and, of course, the documents that Judge Kevin Titus of the 30th District Court, who's joined us today, officially sealed. And they actually had a 4 or 5 minute piece where Kevin was actually in the court setting and the robe, the whole bit, and sealing these documents. And for whatever reason, you know, Kevin was cut out of the show, which I didn't think was right. Mm. And on top of that, the documents were never shown, because when they removed Kevin, they removed the the interest in these documents. And so with that, with respect to that, I've gotten a lot of calls and attention, and people are calling me, you know, several of those people that have contacted me from with regard to interviews had no idea that there were these state documents associated with the case. And again, this is why I'm bringing Kevin on as much as I can, because it's an important piece of this. The material, the supporting documentation, and the recognition this has received over the past 5 or 6 years had an opportunity to really blow up and be in the homes of millions of people. And it was removed. Mm-hmm. And I can't for the life of me understand why you would take one of the most important aspects of a UFO case and have this episode based on that and then not show it.
It strikes me as extremely peculiar, because I know as we spoke before we started the interview, when we were having our chat, Tom, I've been aware of this case for a number of years, obviously not to the depth I now know, because obviously Unsolved Mysteries has really shone a light on it. Have you been frustrated in that sort of respect, in regards to the fact that despite this story and these experiences reaching a whole new audience, once again, we've still not got the full story here, obviously with the situation with Kevin and the legal documentation. Do you think that it's a case of what you see isn't everything, and there's a lot more to this than meets the eye on first viewing?
Well, quite honestly, they didn't show anything in the episode but the flight pattern. There's nothing else. You know, and here's something else. When they interviewed the Great Barrington Police Department and they showed that guy sitting there with this binder, with a ringed binder.
Yes.
You got to ask yourself, first of all, the incident didn't happen in Great Barrington. The incident happened in Sheffield. Yep. And if you look at the Galata's gas station and Eddie Galata, they actually had mentioned more than once that the son, Eddie, had gone out with his father, who was the chief of police of that particular town, in the police car that night looking for this thing because they had gotten so many calls. Yet they kind of focused on Great Barrington, where the incident really didn't happen, except for the incident really with Melanie. Mm. And but that really wasn't reported. The reports came in, the ones that came in were reported from golfers that were at Juggin Resort, and of course Jan Green, who was had gone to the Great Barrington WSBS radio in Great Barrington and knocked on the door, and because Tom Jay had gotten back on the air and was saying, if you see this thing, you know, please call the station. So people were calling the station. Mm. And everybody in the show knew they were calling the station, not so much the police department. And the police department did receive calls. Now picture this: you've got a big town, you have I don't know what it had for residents, but there was a lot. Not to mention, it was also Labor Day, and people were drinking, hanging out, you know, doing things with other people. Mm. Of course, the police incidences, not police reports, because there was no crime. You can't report. You're not going to say there's a police report on a UFO. There's an incident report, not a police report. There was no crime committed. And so the whole thing with that Great Barrington officer really kicked a little bit of the show in the pants, because there was no relevance there. Mm-hmm. You know, police reports keep those who break the law. Yeah. Because you see a UFO, you're not breaking the law. So why would there have been? But there would have been notes there. And I'm also thinking that maybe there were other things on that same page where these police incidences were reported that they may not have wanted to bring to light. You know, maybe somebody's name who was influential in the town. Mm. But I was surprised of that. And again, there wasn't enough attention put to the Great Barrington Police Department. Why didn't they ask the Sheffield Police Department to show their binder? Why didn't they ask them for their reports? Mm. I don't know. I was, there was a lot of things in that show that I think could have been edited better, or there could have been a little more attention on these key pieces of our case. And it really is our case. I mean, it's the Berkshire's UFO brand right now, but at the same time, it's been our case since, you know, went to the United Nations in 1992. But I'm glad these other people were in the show. I mean, that's kind of what the park's about, and that's kind of what I've been trying to do, is bring more locals into, give them a voice.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what I wanted to do. But I didn't expect, there were 9 minutes cut out of this episode. And you can fit a lot of material in those last 9 minutes. And I think that they fell short by not doing that. I'm grateful that they shot it. Don't get me wrong. It's an unbelievable team that came out. The guys were like, my God, I thought I was in Hollywood. I mean, it was crazy. Tractor trailer trucks full of equipment. I mean, they were professional. They had, you know, fax machines and copy machines out in the middle of the park. I mean, I've got some behind-the-scenes footage. It's at you can find it at berkshiresufo.com. Again, at berkshiresufo.com has behind-the-scenes of this stuff. And for that, I think the crew was amazing. The people that were involved in this show, you know, Cindy and Terry and Doug and many others were terrific. For some reason, they cut out stuff they had already filmed. You know, it's not like I'm not blaming Unsolved Mysteries for not filming it or taking it seriously. They did. Mm. It's just, why did it cut on? Why was it left on a cutting room floor?
Yeah. We need to sort of get Kevin's opinion here. I mean, Kevin, when was the first time you kind of this case came to your attention, and how did you get involved in this situation?
Well, that's something I don't know if you know, but back in Tom and his family and my family knew each other. My grandparents knew his father. They lived. He was a selectman here in the area, and everybody. It was a small community. Everybody knew everybody. But that particular weekend of September 1969, I was actually visiting my grandparents, and I went over to a friend's house that where we actually saw the very same thing he did at close to when it was getting dusk. And it, in fact, I live on the house. Where that plateau, where it was seen by over 250 people within a 12-mile radius, it came from that area in Sheffield and waded down to the Canaan, Connecticut area. And so what happened was in 2015, I had come home from Texas. So I was stationed down there in the Army, and I came home and I was touring my old area where I lived. And and I used to know a lot of people, and I went to the monument site. Well, I didn't know it was a monument there. It was the covered bridge. And I saw a monument there, and I said, oh, wow, that might be something to do with the 1787 Shays Rebellion, you know, which took place in that area, which I was interested in. But I went over to it, and as I looked up, I looked at this, like, white block marker close to the bridge by the edge, and I read the plaque, and the plaque said it was the supposedly the site of the first significant historical UFO in U.S. history, and it had a document by the Massachusetts, you know, governor. And I said, wait a minute. When I saw the name Thomas Reed, I go, wait a minute. Thomas Reed, I know the Reed family. Is it the same one? So being a historian and a researcher myself, I have two books out on history. I went ahead and I contacted the Sheffield Police Department to get a hold with Tom. And to make sure Tom thinks I was some kind of a guy that wacko or something, you know, I just called him and said, well, I think Tom and I know each other. Peter Riley, Peter Gibbons, all these kids, you know, Dickinson, we all knew each other as kids. It was a very small community. So, you know, everybody knew about the Tom Reed Diner and Sheffield and things like that. And at that point, Tom called me back, and the next thing we know, we realized that his family and mine were connected, and I had actually seen the very same thing that they saw that same weekend around, it was early in the evening before it got dark. And I remember it very vividly. I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I'll tell you more about that later if you want, but that's how I got back. And decided that not only will I historically research it and get back with Tom, that Tom and I can, you know, work together on trying to preserve this for historical significance.
Yeah.
But there's more to that, Kevin. I mean, you actually saw the craft, too, over the cow field, right?
Yeah, on top of the plateau on the property I own, I have 190 acres here in Caneville, Huntsville, Falls Village area. And the plateau was on the very top. And at this particular time, my friend Jimmy and his family were having the cattle was behind getting down from the hill there. So his father and mother, or actually his father, asked Jimmy and I to go up there and get them because we were hanging out for late in the evening and stuff. And I said, okay, so we went up there. We got to the top of the plateau. There's a little way you can cross up in this barbed wire fence where all the cows used to come down. And when we got to the top, the first thing I looked to my left and I saw a dead cow that had been mutilated to the point of, it wasn't bloody, it was like a pinkish white. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. Hmm. And it looked like that the cow had could have been eaten by coyotes or some kind of wild animal around here. That was enough to scare me. And I, as I looked before I read that, I could see some, you know, round circular burn marks on the top. And I just said, you know, Jimmy, you know, screw this, I'm running down. He was like, what, what? And I ran down there as fast as I could. I never knew I could outrun him either, and I did. And he looked to the right, and he, when he finally got down, he told me there were the other two cows, the other one cow that was missing was on the right side with the same implodement, explodement, I don't know what you call it. And he was scared. And as we ran down, we got to the balcony. I guess you call it the outside wooden deck out in the back of their house. Like I have one here. Hmm. And I looked up, and as we're looking down, we're yelling. We thought this eagle type, it looked like a turtle shell kind of thing, and it had a really dim light. It was above the clouds. I wouldn't say called trees. It was up there really high. Hmm. It had a very faint light. And for me, I didn't know what the hell it was. At 11 and 12 years old, you don't make stuff up like that. You look up and you see and you run. And I thought it was actually following us. That's what I thought.
When you investigated this, and they had even Ancient Aliens did a piece on you about the investigation and the years you spent looking into this, how many people would say were witnesses, total witnesses, not like in a town, but in the neighboring communities as well?
Within a 12-mile radius from, we'll say, Great Barrington, Sheffield, down to Canaan, Connecticut, this area down here, with a 12-mile radius. So over 250 people called into the radio, WSBS, the local police, the state police here, and they also called the Army Reserve Air Force Base over there in Great Barrington, which now is a private airport. When we called down, my grandparents called, they said that they had no airplanes up that day that they could contend up, but the radar technician looking, he said he saw something very strange that was seen over this area at that time.
Words he used, right? There was something strange, right? That
very
was the word
strange.
Yeah.
It wasn't a helicopter airplane. It was something strange. It was moving from that area, and they could track it. And they're like, but they couldn't explain it. Nobody could. And, you know, then, of course, as we saw it, what happened is what happened. A lot of us, you know, kind of put it out of our mind. And Tom went through a lot of time with his family, it's, you know, over this thing. His father passed away when it went to the UN. And so as you get into more, I had to research it. I checked in the National Archives. And I did find an archive that said that on that particular weekend, there was a radar technician that reported on radar something very peculiar, which was classified for a very long time.
What has surprised me, and what struck me when I watched the episode, Tom, was I was very upset when I heard about what your family had gone through, especially the way certain people behave towards your mum. I mean, I thought your mum is a wonderful woman. She's clearly very proud of you and fully supports your honesty and your coming forward with this and your battle to keep this story in the forefront of people's minds, Tom. And it struck me that as a family, you clearly had to deal with a lot of personal abuse in regards to this situation, which when Kevin's explaining the situation, and obviously now we know more than just your family were party to this,
right?
When you look back, can you explain why you think so many people treated you negatively? Do you think it was because you weren't locals, you were out of towners that had moved there, or do you think that people just didn't want to admit what had happened?
Well, if you look at what's going on at the monument, you know, let's go backwards. If you look at what has happened recently, you still have that personality. You still have that odd dynamic that, you know, this. I don't really understand how anybody even today, even after the Elon Musk and the Star Wars and all the everything that we're seeing right now, the Pentagon, you know, introducing UFOs and still using the term world incident, which was in our state documents in 2015, and of course the radio archives and how this is in museums and everything, yet you still have people even today that wanted to remove our monument. You know, as far as why, I have no freaking clue how you can be that ignorant. But you know, going back now, you know, 50 years into 1969, we moved in to the Berkshires from New York. Mm. And my mother, you know this, you know, was from Hollis, Queens. My father was from Patchogue, Long Island. I was born in New York. And so at that time in the 60s, there was in Sheffield, Sheffield Great Barrington line, there was a racetrack. It was the second largest racetrack to Saratoga. And it was, you know, considered to be somewhat fixed, you know.
Yes.
It was a lot of horses, a lot of money, a lot of betting, a lot of money coming in from New York, the Hartford area, Boston. It was a massive race. It was a big racetrack. Evel Knievel used to jump there. I mean, it was a big racetrack. So you had a lot of people coming in from outside the area. And so our diner was filled with a lot of New Yorkers and, you know, those from Connecticut and so on, as well as a lot of the locals. Now, I'm not putting anybody down, but, you know, Sheffield was a farming community, yet you've got high roller New Yorkers coming in. So you had this strange dynamic, and I think they didn't want that. You know, they didn't want to be invaded by New Yorkers, right? This was their community, right? This was their town, you know? And, of course, with that said, we were part of that influx of New Yorkers. And then, of course, when you have a UFO incident and you're vocal about it because you have the diner, that's the spot that you run into so many people, and it comes up in conversation. And of course, when you mention it to one person on Monday, Tuesday they come in and they want to mention it again, and then they want to talk to their friends. This is the person, this is the kid that saw this. And now it'll be, you know, even though Unsolved Mysteries said, oh, these guys didn't talk about it, I've talked about it my whole life. Our family talked about it our whole life. There was a time when we stopped talking about it because it was getting violent. You know, we were showing there was a lot of violence coming in our direction. But we talked about it. We were the first ones to get up and dance, right? We were the ones who talked about it. We're the ones who brought it to reminded people. My a politician and an attorney, he was so dedicated to trying to return some of that validation to those people who did also part-time as we did. And the way for him to do that was to partner up with a friend, an attorney in Manchester, Connecticut. His first name was Robert, who was organizing the United Nations Symposium. You know, there was a meeting that our legally retained attorney discussed our case in front of Mohammed Robinson, the president of the Parapsychology Society, at the United Nations. And my father died on that same day. So when they rolled out the monument and they started to pay tribute to our family, I was honored, and I dedicated that entire day to my late father. And then after the monument was installed, then the place became a bit of a tourist attraction. And what did they do? So the locals, some of those old school locals, well, let's take his monument. So to answer your question, I don't know what's going on with these people's heads. I have no idea what their problem is. I mean, this is their town's history. It was validated. It's in museums. It was given, you know, it was the first UFO case in the United States to be deemed historically true in Sheffield, not Great Barrington. And it's not like we're celebrating a serial killer here. So yes. I don't know why they act this way. It's ludicrous. I've banged my head against the wall many night, you know, wondering, is it personal? You know, but I think to be honest with you, I think that we just have a lot of, I don't live in that town, by the way. I live 1,000 miles away. I don't even live there. But Kevin runs across, I think to answer your question more directly, that I would say that 95 or 98% of the area supports this 100%. But you still have some of those old local roots that they're fallen angels. They like to reference the tinfoil hat crowd. They throw wackadoodles along, you know, words like wackadoodles in a local paper sometimes when they're interviewed about how they feel about the topic. But at this juncture, at this time, this isn't taboo anymore. This is factual. We know this. I mean, there's more truth to ufology than there is that God ever was here. I mean, we have radar. We have pictures. We have proof. We have documents from the Pentagon, the United Nations. To not support this, in my opinion, is just really shows a lack of common sense.
It's very interesting because I've been fortunate enough, Tom, to speak to a gentleman called Calvin Parker, who is synonymous with the Pascagoula incident down in Mississippi.
Yeah,
Calvin's story is quite similar because he simply couldn't cope with this spotlight on him at the time. I mean, he was a very young man at the time. Obviously, I mean, he was certainly older than yourself was during this incident, Tom. But he basically hid away for the best part of 40 years because he simply couldn't cope with the harassment and being tarnished, as you say, as someone that was simply looking for attention or maybe not in control of his faculties. And yet, because he's now come forward over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, he's now discovered that he wasn't the only person that saw something that night. He wasn't the only person that reported something. And yet, I can often feel deep sympathy for people in these situations, Tom, because it must sometimes feel like the loneliest place on earth, because you're absolutely steadfast in what's happened to you, what you've experienced, how it's affected you, and for yourself, you and your family. To feel like that for a certain length of time and then get validation only to have the carpet pulled from under you once again.
Yeah, exactly.
Must be so frustrating. And then, once again, now we have the situation where everybody, you know, millions of people have watched this new season of Netflix. It's been a massive success. It must still be so frustrating that they don't seem to want to. I mean, and this happens occasionally in other incidents, Tom and Kevin, where you have certain towns where, you know, with the greatest respect, not a lot happens and they're struggling financially, businesses are going under left, right and centre because there's no reason for people to come there anymore. And yet here you have, as you say, a tourist attraction. You know, the park has been on TripAdvisor, it's been on Atlas Obscura, you know, it's become renowned around the world, and yet here we have a small minority of people who would rather see their town struggle than embrace this incredible event.
This is very dear to me. I'm very, Tom will tell you this is so. I personally look at this, in my view, the UFO, I should take back, this is the Gettysburg of UFO history, and it's it looks exactly as it did 50 years ago. We have a historical monument there. My idea was we'd like to get a kiosk with a little map to tell people, because all the sites and everything are still there, right up to the telephone pole where Tom and his family's car stopped. And I look at it as a historical significance. We're trying to save this for historical generations after we're gone.
Mm.
So people will say, hey, where's the site? Well, this happened in Sheffield, Massachusetts in 1969, 100 years ago. And people are going to look back and look at the Tom Reed family, and they're going to look back at the Roswell Historical UFO Historical Museum in Roswell, Mexico, where they have my papers there that I've signed. That, you know, somebody say, hey, that's the judge that made that into a historical park 100 years ago. This is how we look at it, as we want to preserve it as what I said before, the Gettysburg of UFO history.
And yet they still don't know how to deal with it. They don't know what to make of it. It's almost like they kind of love the fact that it's bringing in tourism, like you said, because let's face it, they do like that. But I think at this juncture, I think the town, is what they're trying to do is they're trying to rebrand the park. They want to have control of it. And I really do think that at the end of the day, it has to do with control. We, you know, that park or that UFO Monument Park is on private property. It always has been. The town actually installed that monument onto the private park, or that private land at the park, you know, is renowned, you know, or location of that park. And the reason that the town installed the monument on that private land is because back in the day when they had the road going through this bridge, that road was originally for horse and buggy.
Yeah.
This is how old the town is. And so when they started bringing cars through it, they realized that it wasn't easable. There, you could not have two cars meet in the middle of that road and get around each other. And so the town lost their road. They actually lost the right of passage through this private property, which is owned by a dairy farm. And so because the road was no longer That's where they put the monument, and they turned us into a beautiful park. However, the town has since said, well, wait a minute, we may have lost a rite of passage, but theoretically or technically or however they want to spin this thing, they like to sell the fact that they still maintain an easement. And so 2 weeks after the Unsolved Mysteries filmed at the park, they came in, it was 2 to 3 weeks, they came in and removed the monument. And with the idea of rebranding this park, you know, the Berkshire's UFO Park, no longer the Tom Reed UFO Monument Park. How can you have a monument park with no monument, right? Mm. So they thought, well, you know, let's rebrand it. The thinking here, and this came from a reporter who actually interviewed some people in town, never ran the story because he thought it was absolutely disgusting that the town would want to do this. Or certain, I shouldn't say the town, certain individuals working within the town. The town itself, right. Shepherd, they're nice people. I mean, I wanted to do this for the town. That's what my idea was, to pay something forward to the community. Yeah. But you still have a few select people that are thinking, well, wait a minute. If we take out the monument and we put in a new sign, now we can, you know, put a food truck in there. You know, we can have some control of what happens over there. But, you know, so I think it started out with we don't like that topic. We don't want the to be laughed at, you know, like they think they would be laughed at because they don't know any better. You know, be laughed at. You know, we don't want that element in here. We don't, you know, they use the word element in an article. Mm. You know, tinfoil hat. So they think they thought it was kind of silly at first, but then when over the years when it grew and grew and grew, and you had all these TV shows donating, you know, Ancient Aliens donated the new sculpture, the centerpiece for the park now. You know, Unsolved Mysteries has given us a donation. Travel Channel has, Roswell Museum, you know, Travis Walton, Ben Hansen from Factor Fake, Mike Barra from Ancient Aliens, Shockwave Motors, an electric car manufacturer. I mean, they've all donated park benches or solar lights and willow trees and flowers and plants and gravel, you know. I mean, it's been, you know, mulch. And people just go to that park out of the goodness of their heart and start donating to that park. There's people there today that are putting in new plants, you know, 4 to 6 foot flowering bushes in the backside of the park. And I think that the town is going, wait a minute, there's something here. Maybe we were wrong about our initial assumption of what this was going to be. And so now it's not a matter of, you know, we don't want it anymore. It's how do we control it? How do we get control of this? And the way to do that was by trying to revisit an old easement and rebranding the park to a name that the town could have control over. So now that's really what this is about, according to this reporter who interviewed many people and let me listen to the recordings. I heard the recordings. So I'm telling you, from this is not an idea or a thought. I heard these recordings, because when the reporter was talking to these people, he recorded them on his cell phone, you know, the app. He played them for me, and I was absolutely shocked to find out that this is all about a rebranding effort.
Yeah. I mean, I find it staggering, to be honest, gentlemen, because, you know, as we said before we went on air, Tom, it's amusing to me, because when I watched the show, obviously I'm not ignorant enough to think that I live in the only place called Sheffield in the world. However, it just really struck me that this happened in a town called Sheffield. There is another smaller town outside called Stockbridge. Here in Sheffield, there is a town outside of Sheffield called Stocksbridge. you have Mansfield Lake. Down the road from Sheffield is the town of Mansfield. So as I was saying to Tom before we started recording, clearly whoever went there was from this area of England, because there are so many places in that location that essentially have been lifted and just put there. And for me, it's one of those things, because everybody in the world who's into the weird and the wonderful knows where Point Pleasant is. Right. And why do they know that? They know that because of Mothman, because they've embraced it, because they understand the importance and the validation of the people that experience something weird at that point, Kevin. So I'm perplexed, because I'd never heard of Sheffield. And with the greatest respect, I would imagine there are people who live in the United States who have no idea that there is a town called Sheffield.
Right.
You're probably right, but you know Sheffield because you know because such there's such a historical connection to our former mother country of UK back in you know the 16th, 17th centuries. I mean, this area was these towns were born in like the 1730s, and a lot of those people did come from UK and in England and Wales and all kinds, and they rediscovered the colonies as they used to call. They still call us the colonists, and so, and it's amazing the connection to where the you know Sheffield. Sheffield, well, in my view, historic, that means it's kind of like you're related or the cousin city to Sheffield, Mass, USA, to the, you know, cousin of Sheffield, UK.
And that, for me, is one of the things that really struck me, because like I said at the beginning of the conversation, I was aware of this case, but I'd never, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was called the Berkshire Incident, so I wasn't aware that it had occurred over the town of Sheffield. I wasn't aware that these things had happened in these locations. So it's really struck a chord with me, not because I'm simply obsessed with anything to do with Sheffield, but it just, it's resonated with me primarily because of the witnesses and the story and the secondary line about what's been going on about who actually owns this incident, because I think that seems to be going on here.
Here's the thing. Why didn't they call it the Tom Reed Off-World Incident like it says in the official records?
Exactly.
Why would you rename it? I'm not knocking the fact they wanted to call it. It did happen throughout the Berkshires, so I get that. But it was almost like a dismantling of sorts, and that's how I kind of took it. It's like you rename it. You don't show our documents. You don't mention anything about the loss of my father or dying on the same day that this case was mentioned at the United Nations, or talk about how we have four separate letters from the state. And I'll give you another example of why this was so important to me. You know, Judge Kevin Titus sealed, I think it was four, if not five, documents from the state. How many documents are you aware of that were sealed, issued by the state and sealed by Kevin? I'm just curious because I just want to make a point here. How many documents are you aware of?
Anything more than one says to me that there's clearly something to this.
Yeah, so how many are you aware of, though, yourself?
Four, five?
Okay. How many of your listeners probably know that there are four or five? That never gets mentioned.
Yeah.
But what they talk about is how, and you probably read this, that there were the original, the citation from the governor, not one of them, the citation from the governor was written in error. That is absolutely not true by any stretch of the imagination. The very first citation was missing the date of incident. And I'm sure you have proclamations in the UK. When you're given a proclamation or you are getting a day of remembrance in your family's honor, whatever it is, when you're issued a citation from the governor, it has to have the particular date so they know when it happened. Well, when the governor signed it, it had my birthday on it because they wanted to make sure that I was a Thomas E. Reed born on such and such a date. So when he saw the date, he thought that was the date of incident, and he signed off on it, along with the lieutenant governor, and then it was sealed by Kevin. But because it was when it went to or was reviewed by the Historical Society or however that happened, it got kicked back to the governor's office, and they said, wait a minute, that was written in error. So there was an error in the citation because it was lacking the date that this took place. And so the governor and the lieutenant governor reissued it 3 weeks later in November. But you still have, and this goes back to answering again, the attitude by certain people in the area, just like a particular journalist by the name of Terry Cowgill, who I've already made aware that we're suing him for blatant malice and slander, because he knows that there was two citations. He also knows about the monument, who put it there, and yet he says in the front page of the newspaper, governor says he wrote that in error. So now it's lost its, or something like that. That's not true. The governor of Massachusetts does not write back-to-back mistakes to the same person 3 weeks apart by inducting them into the state of Massachusetts for making history.
And so
that's, we're fighting that. Frustrating, like you said. Am I frustrated? Of course I am. And then, you know, Kevin sealed that. And one of the reasons I think Kevin too took an interest and wanted to be part of this thing, he is an historian, and he did know my late father, you know, before he was killed. And so there are some good-hearted people out there who have stepped up and said, yeah, we're with you, my friend. You know, we saw it too, and we don't understand why this is happening. And that's why the park is exploding. I mean, I can't believe the amount of support it's getting by people I've never met.
Yeah.
And so it's a beautiful thing, you know. And there are three people who have lost their lives, who's have a memorial bench in there, or a mention of their family members. You know, Gingras, who I went to school with, was a friend. I knew the family, and he lost his life at an early age. And his wife decided to sponsor a bench and put his name on it. So we've got a bench in that park that is. You know, it's a very heartfelt park, but in a lot of ways, if you just knew details of this thing. And so she donated a bench with his name on it to the park. And then, of course, my late father, his name was on the original plaque on the monument before it was spray painted and had graffiti written all over it. And they put a cross, X across the plaque with my father's name on it. When it was unveiled in his honor on national television, it was covered live by ABC News New York. And then, of course, there's Stanton Friedman, who I think we all know who Stanton Friedman is.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he played a part in our case getting into the Roswell Museum, and he actually has a picture with me at the Roswell Museum holding up the first induction letter by the Historical Society before it was, you know, hung on the wall in Roswell. And so when he passed a little over a year ago, I guess, you know, a friend of his wife's went and bought a like a $9,000 outdoor telescope in his honor to be installed in my park. So Stanton Friedman will be forever remembered in our park. And again, you know, I don't see how anybody can look at what this park stands for, you know, and what it means. And it is in Sheffield. And, you know, a name that's known for in the field of ufology because of the United Kingdom, you know, because of your Sheffield. And it's a little ironic, but there's a lot of little things that line up in a way that you could never imagine, you know, like not only is, you know, Sheffield and you know, how this has grown by the love of people and the good heart of people and those who have been picked on in their lives or had to face such, you know, they don't get the start on their football team because, you know, they talk about UFOs or, or they're laughed at or mocked or, you know, because they see things a little bit differently, or maybe their minds are more open than the average person, or
but
just.
That's another reason, Tom, we should tell this gentleman, is another reason that what he's saying is true is because, to going back to the documents a minute, the documents are make them, when I seal them, they're an uncontested document. It means nobody can change it. I'm the only person in the world that could ever have changed it, and I can't, because once you seal something, that's it. It's a legal document. It's part of history. The seal is on there, my signature, my date of, you know, ending, everything. And it, and what we're trying to do is to prove, as Tom is saying in the long run here, is that we're trying to maintain this with total respect, historical significance, and that there'll be no contesting of it, in that word. And there's been so many things, there's so many documents and so many tests have been taken. I mean, we could tell you what the ground is like, the giant corn cobs that are growing there, the stalks. This is all not made up. This is real. It's
Have you ever seen the corn that Kevin's talking about, I don't know if you grow corn in the UK, but right where this incident took place in Sheffield, you have corn on a cob. And correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but it's like 2.5 feet long.
And how long are the stalks? Like 17, 18 feet tall? The normal is about 8 or 10?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you go half a mile or down the road or even not even that far, the corn doesn't grow anywhere near as big as it does. You have corn that is growing at an enormous rate. Now, another thing, not only does the corn grow sometimes 2.5 feet long, and there's pictures of it on my website, I think. Some of it actually grows in a ball. Have you ever seen corn grow in a ball?
No. I mean, was this area known for this beforehand, or has this happened since?
It all happened right afterwards.
Right.
And are you also aware that there have been two crop circles that have showed up there in 2013 and 2014?
No.
Yes.
And did you know that there was absolutely, there's spots in that field where absolutely nothing can grow? We've had tests and scientists there have checked the soil. Mm-hmm. The soil has a higher rate of radiation and is magnetically something very unstable. And, I mean, you can't grow. I mean, they've tried in those spots. It will not grow. And it's no different than the ground there. Right, Tom?
Right, absolutely. And there's something else about our Sheffield, since we're going down this route. I find this fascinating because, again, this is stuff that is never told. You know what they tell? Oh, a UFO went over Reed's car, blah, blah, blah. You know, this quick little wow factor, and they move on. I mean, there is so much here. The magnesium. And
right.
The magnesium that was mined for the atom bomb was mined just 3 miles from my park and our family's restaurant.
That's absolutely true.
What?
And because of that, there was government in the area because there was a plutonium spill, I believe. So the government wasn't sure how to contain it back in the day. So they had government watching that. Not only that, but you had Command Aerospace, you had Pratt & Whitney, you had Sikorsky Aircraft, you have General Electric, the Groton Naval Nuclear Submarine Base right there. You had all these government manufacturing facilities on top of NORAD towers and Nike missile sites and Missilemen missile sites, all in the Berkshire Mountains, all within about a 45-minute drive from that incident in Sheffield, Mass., where we encountered these three UFOs. And so you got to say to yourself, and I think the historians and many others never, ever questioned that something was seen that night or we encountered something that night. It was simply a matter of what was it. But you never hear of any of this. You never hear about the government being seen walking out of the woods. You know, it's such a travesty to have all this right there in black and white.
Mm.
Not ever mention it on a single television show.
It's almost as if the area has some kind of magnetic pull to the government, that clearly they feel that this area is something special, because with the greatest of respect, I would suggest that Massachusetts was not a prime area for invasion on anybody's agendas.
Not since 1775, no.
Exactly. So that is extremely perplexing. I mean, it is one of those strange things where, you know, I've spoken to people who have investigated what they call window areas, gentlemen, where okay. There seems to be a specific area of you know, there are numerous areas in America. Obviously, probably the nearest one to you guys is the Bridgewater Triangle. So it strikes me as there clearly is something very unusual about this area of the Berkshires that seems to be wanting to have the authorities there as though they can keep their eyes on things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I can contest, Tom, that over there by it's called Sunset area. It's called something number two, Lime Rock Lane number two or something, where they took all this magnesium and make the atomic bomb. They still have signs over there that say U.S. government, no trespassing. And you see sometimes you'll see these black U.S. government SUVs going down there. And you can't tell. They're wearing all black, kind of like a flight suit type thing with glasses. You know, that typical kind of covering me type thing. And you go up there, they won't let you down there. And there's really nothing to see. It's an abandoned, you know, magnesium. But for some reason, there's still a lot of government activity, you know, around here. You'll see them occasionally, and you're wondering, what are they doing over there by an old swampy area? And this is one of the areas where they worked on the magnesium for the, you know, Lime Rock to make the atomic bomb back in the 1940s.
Mm. Yeah, but there's still a lot of activity there, too. I mean, they're taking pictures now. I mean, the cell phones and everything. There are people that will just walk it through the park, and not just my park, but around my park. There's a dirt road. A lot of people walk their dogs there. Mm. And they'll take their little cell phones and just snap pictures, and they actually send me these photos of this sphere, like what we saw back in 1969, but it's smaller. These small, self-contained little spheres that look like pool balls, you know, balls from a pool table, yeah. You know, a cue ball. They're solid, and they see them over these cornfields. And then, like I said, this is a common thing. There was sightings in 1966, 1967, 1974, you know, 69 being the big one, back in the 80s. And then you've got the crop circles in 2013, 2014. I mean, this is an area that doesn't sleep. I mean, this area is alive with activity, and maybe that's why they're still there. Maybe there is some, you know, pushback by accepting this thing, and maybe there's a little bit of a struggle there, or maybe that's what they're, you know, fighting with. Like you take the Great Barrington Historical Society, they're the ones who actually inducted this case into state. It wasn't even the town of Sheffield. Mm. Sheffield didn't induct it. This is what's so bizarre. The town of Sheffield, where this actually happened, did not induct it into state. The neighboring town of Great Barrington did. And the only reason that they were able to do it was because that I was buried in my name and my family's name was buried in the 1976 time capsule in Great Barrington. So they buried this time capsule, the bicentennial, you know, 1976 year, and our names were in it. Therefore, they could connect us to being residents of Great Barrington. And because the radio station, WSBS Radio, actually broadcasted, they could connect and make this part of Great Barrington. But again, it didn't happen there. It happened in Sheffield. And so you've got all these little moving pieces. So you're like, why is Sheffield acting this way? And I think it you know, obviously there's a branding effort now because it's a tourist attraction. But originally, there was some blowback. There was some pushback. There was a reason that they were so stubborn about not moving forward with it, because at first they wanted nothing to do with it, even though it was that police officer who got in the freaking car that night with his son and went out looking for the freaking thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. None.
So many called in the radio station, you know, they had it. They had people calling saying, like, you got to look. And they're looking, and everybody was going out. And when you have, which is in my findings, my historical archives, I will write that when you have over 250 some odd people within a 12-mile range area seeing this thing, it's not made up. No one in half these two, they don't even know each other. So how could they make that up?
And most people saw different things. Like what we saw when we came over that bridge, and I haven't even mentioned this on the show yet. When we went through that Sheffield Bridge in our car, I was behind my mother who was driving. My brother was behind my grandmother in the passenger seat. We were in a blue Bel Air station wagon. Mm. When we first went through that bridge, my grandmother later referenced that there was a bleed of light coming through the planks of the boards that – she believed that that's where it was coming from, because there was way too much bleed of light in going through the bridge. Not so much that headlights didn't light it up enough, but there was a brighter light, like there was a cross light of some kind, you know, almost like laser lights, you know, or yeah. So it threw off the headlights, you know. You're like, what is that? And when we got on the other side of that bridge, and I was giving my brother the candy, my grandmother turned around to remind me not to give it to him. He was too young, he could choke. that a million times because I'll never forget it. She was facing back towards the bridge, which is why she was the first one to really notice this sphere of light coming up from the banks of the Housatonic River. Mm. I don't know if it was underwater. I don't know where it came from. But when I saw it, it was about four times the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And again, it looked very much like a cue ball, like a slightly illuminated cue ball from a pool table, a big one. It was that dense. It was like, I used to refer to it a lot as a bubble, like when you blow a bubble, you know, because it has a tight ring around it. But this was a very solid object. It wasn't like a hazy white, you know, round thing in the sky. It was solid. It was like if you threw a rock at it, you would have hit it and you would have hurt it. You know, that's how it looked to me. And so with that was object number one. And then there was an object number two, which was very similar, but it was orange in color. It had like a moving center, almost like a wave or like a you know, something was turning in it, or it was very different as far as the makeup of it.
Yeah.
It was more alive looking, you know, like something was going on inside of it.
Mm.
And it did look much smaller to me. Now, whether they were the same size, but it was much further away. But that, too, was also over water. And then the object number three was the craft that looked like had the turtle shell look to it that I've referenced in Kevin as well and many others, was kind of in front of us at like 11 o'clock. So if you look at where we were, before I go any further with this, we were in the center of a triangle of three moving objects.
Mm.
So that...
And you know, you have a diorama of that, diorama of the craft was in the museum, which is a very impressive recreate, but he posted something with a more detailed you know, image of what it was.
So again, even though, don't get me wrong, I loved Unsolved Mysteries, they didn't talk about three different objects. They talked about one. Mm. There were multiple objects that night. Gina Paul, who lived down the street on Boardman Street, who I used to walk to school with, they saw numerous objects that night. There wasn't one. And so some were round spheres, which are still seen in the area today. And the third one was this turtle shell looking object. So when we started to continue down this road, that cue ball looking white sphere rose up and started going in our direction. But it fired two poles of light into the water. I mean, it was just like, you know, almost forming the shape of an ice cream cone, which is how Ancient Aliens described it. It showed it looking like an ice cream cone. And for a moment or two, it kind of did, because the top was that solid vanilla piece, right, and the bottom looked like a sugar cone. And for a moment or maybe 5 seconds or whatever it was, that's how it looked.
Mm.
And those rods of light either went back into it or dissolved completely. And then the object started to move in the direction of – in the same general direction as our car, but behind a line of trees. And for a moment or two, we do believe we saw a bleed of light coming through the trees now and then. So it did seem to, like, at will put out light. Boom, put out light, crack, put out light, but never itself changing. It just could shoot light out from it somehow, whether it was these rods, whatever it was. And so when we got down the road a little bit further, my mother started to pull off near this telephone pole. You could feel a change. You could feel like a heaviness, like being submerged underwater. And yet we started to hear this tapping sound, like tap, like the back tires were kicking up stones and it was hitting the underneath of the fender wall. Whether that was really what it is, I used to believe that it was, but again, it could have been anything, but that's what it sounded like to me. So everything was muted, but any little sound that was nearby was amplified, just like being under a pool, you know, when you're inside of a pool. And so that is kind of what we felt. That's how everything went silent, you know. It was like, and it was all, like I said, it's almost like someone just flipped a switch off on life itself and everything became kind of solemn and you know, like surreal. Yeah. And you're not there, but you're kind of there, and everything, you just altered, and the whole area was altered around you. There was no crickets, there was no birds, there was no sign of life. It was dead silent, almost like the entire area was underwater. You know what I mean? Like there was nothing. but you could feel the pressure on them. And we started to get, like, I wouldn't say panic, but we all knew at the same, it was like everybody's body and feeling was changing simultaneously. We all experienced this weirdness together, whatever it was. But yet we were still looking out the window while this was affecting our bodies and seeing this craft. And I've tried to describe the craft, like, it's not shiny. It was not like a chrome. It didn't come to a point. It was, they had this big band around the middle of it. The center of it was like the same distance as the top and bottom combined. So you had the small top piece, the smaller bottom piece, and this fat little wide piece that went around the outside of it, which almost looked like a snake skin.
Yeah.
And then the top of it too had like these panels in it, and the right side was brighter than the left. The right side I could see better. It had like patches of like a bronze or a copper and like a pewter, all kind of blended in, like someone took a blowtorch to the thing and some of it cooling at different temperatures, you know, that kind of thing. But something very seldom ever gets picked up too was it wasn't the light underneath it that brought this thing to life where you could see it. The shell or the skin or however you want to word it put off its own little luminous light to it. So the craft itself was luminous. It wasn't the light on the bottom that gave, you know, that gave off the majority of the light needed to see it. I mean, it was there, but it was the skin of this thing, and it was like 100 yards. I know I've mentioned it, how big this thing was, but I say to myself, well, I was a kid, you know, so maybe things seemed a little bit bigger. But the truth of the matter is, you go back there today and you look at this area and you look at the trees and where this thing was, and my mother was 29 at the time, there was not, this was about 100. And again, that craft at the time was over water. It's kind of dried up now. Kevin's been there with me. It's, yeah. I guess, kind of swampy over there. But at the back in 1969, the craft was over water. The white sphere was over water. And the orange piece, the orange sphere, was over. All three pieces were over water. And we were in a car of four people. Melanie was on Unsolved Mysteries. She was in a car with four people.
Yeah.
She was at Mansfield. She was also near water. And when she was no longer in her car, it was about the same time that we were now gone from our car. So we were both taken out of a car or near water at basically the same time. Her incident was about 8 o'clock. Ours was around 8:30, quarter of nine. And I remember a hangar, a big hangar with fluorescent tubes, and hearing my mother call for us, and later on getting back into the, you know, my grandmother coming to in the car, but now she's in the driver's seat and my mother's in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
You know, and I use the word abstracted from our car because, quite honestly, you know, being that our car was turned off and our lights were off, I mean, doesn't that kind of speak of human error?
Yeah.
And because of these bases and manufacturing facilities in Sheffield, and the magnesium spill, and having these three objects that are even seen today are still in the area. I mean, I would think with all these government manufacturing facilities and the government in general in that area, that they would be all over whatever this is. I mean, this seems to happen at will. I mean, you don't see jets flying over the town. You don't see any of that.
Yeah.
Yet there's a lot of government there. So you would think that if you've got, you would occasionally see an Apache helicopter or something, right? And Kevin, you live there. You don't really see anything like that, but yet you'll see government walking out of the woods.
Right. You'll see the area where they come out and they have government vehicles and they come out and they'll lock the gates and it'll say no trespassing. You don't see any like major type government equipment, but you see government vehicles and they're always buzzing in and around the areas, and you know, you act like, what the hell is, you know, are they doing here? There's nothing here anymore, you know, but there has to be something still around that they're interested in.
Or underground, and I believe I was underground.
Yeah.
I believe I was taken to an underground facility, and I believe that the government was working in conjunction with whatever this was that we encountered, you know, the off-world, you know, there had to be a joint effort. Either we were hit by some, you know, communication between these three pieces and we were out and taken by government for whatever reason. But I remember seeing what looked, you know, very peculiar, like an ant-like figure. Two of them, I ran into this hallway, which was as large as inside of an empty Walmart. It was much bigger than the craft we saw.
Mm.
So where we were, I believe, was, you know, affiliated with some government-funded group.
I have to say, Tom, when yourself and your mother are talking about the incident, the one bit that, not that I, you know, not that I disbelieved anybody involved in this, because the one thing I found extremely compelling about the whole thing was the normalness of everybody that was interviewed, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
When you're recounting the fact that when you come round, I have to say, I got goosebumps when you're telling that your mum and your grandmother had switched places. And at that mm-hmm. point, I could feel the hair standing up on my arms, because that, just to me, like you say, did someone make a mistake? Did they forget who was where? It just blew me away to hear this whole situation. And the fact that you've got two witnesses to this incident who are cast iron in their belief of what occurred. And then you've got these other people from all different walks of life, all different parts of the community, all coming forward with similar incidents, who all seem to have this kind of reticence about being honest about it. Because one of the things I often find frustrating in regards to people such as yourself and your mum and the other witnesses involved in this, like Jane and Melanie, is the fact that we can see what happens to people who are brave enough to come forward, Tom, with a story like this, with an experience like this. They're ridiculed. They're called every name under the sun. They're run out of town. You're humiliated in your mother's business. You know, these people are ostracized from the community. And I've yet to ever see anybody in a situation such as yourself. And you can look at this in regards to numerous witnesses to events. You only have to look at what happened in the Phoenix event, where thousands of people saw something and they were all ridiculed, made to feel foolish, and the media latched onto this nonsensical excuse that it was some micro flight pilots in formation, which completely ignores the vast majority of the witnesses and what they saw, because they were all describing an enormous craft that was blocking out the stars. I'm often both astounded and humbled when I hear people such as yourself, Tim, who are brave enough to come forwards and stick to this story. And this is not something that you've recently started doing, like you say, because you have consistently tried to get answers in regards to this event. You have consistently stuck to the story. You haven't wavered in your belief. Your mother hasn't wavered in her belief, both in the event and her support for yourself, which is clear to see for anybody who's seen the program. And it's touching and it's moving to see that that bond is still there 51 years on, Tom.
Yeah, there's a lot of good that has come from this too. If you look at Melanie used to come in our diner before 69.
Mm.
And, she also had encountered 1969 like we did. And this is something that doesn't get up, you know, much attention either. But let me back up here 1 second. Our diner and our incident mm. made United States history. Our diner made United States history because it was proven to have divided the community. It altered the natural progression of the community. And like Billy the Kid, you know, he altered the railroad, that kind of thing.
Mm.
Because our diner had such a profound effect, it was found to have been historically true because it had such a the fights, the push and shove situations. You had children in school drawing what they saw and taping them on the chalkboard, and they would get, you know, in trouble or picked on too. So all these kids would come back to our diner and we would ride to school together on banana seat bikes, and they would hang out there after school because we had the jukebox. And so it became a very social spot. But then you'd have these people coming in who wanted to pick on everybody in the diner, just make fun of everyone. And so with that said, you did have children who became somewhat recluse, children that, really couldn't count on anyone. Their friends even would turn on them, that kind of thing. And Melanie would come in a lot of the times with her boyfriend at the time. She was older than me. And they would go up to my mother, and she'd get food to go. Mm. I never actually really talked to her about anything, but you could tell in her eyes, you could see and feel a certain way about people, and they would look at you and you'd look at them, and there was this connection, and there were other people like that too. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it brought people together in the same way that it divided people.
Mm.
And that's kind of what the park is. I mean, for me, the park is there to let all those other children who struggle too, that this is for you. This is a judgment-free park.
Yeah.
And you take this this girl I met recently. She actually lives in Prince Edward Island.
Mm.
Her and I are pretty close now. It's amazing. We just have this. We can talk without ever saying anything.
Yeah.
We all feel the same way about a lot of things. I mean, she's amazing. And it's kind of like, in some respects, Melanie, who I've actually never met in person. I talked to her on the phone, and there you are again. There's like this all-knowing type of thing where you just kind of, you're on the same page. There's this different level. I don't know how this has happened, but the people behind this park, the people that have supported this park and were there back in the day, it's like family. I mean, literally, it's there's this bond. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I could look at the negatives and say, it was terrible, right? Mm-hmm. I think I'm part of something magnificent, and I feel like I was privileged to be part of it. And if you remove the crap and the naysayers and all the, mudslinging, it actually was quite inspiring time.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at something that big hovering over a field in complete silence with a shell somewhat putting off somewhat of a light and seeing these things move the way they do, you are just fixated. You are like, what is that?
Yeah.
And you're staring at this thing, but as an adult, of course, your mind is going to take it to, well, what does that mean for the United States? What does that mean for our world? What is happening here? Are we, your mind starts would be like, oh, are we under attack? Is this good? Is this bad? But as a child, you don't think of that.
No.
You're just looking at this thing and you're awestruck. So my brother and I were awestruck, whereas my mother was a little bit more like, oh my God, what does this mean?
Yeah.
Although we all experienced the same thing, we had different friendships, different relationships. We had a different feeling about what this was. So in Unsolved Mysteries, I was saying, well, we were at the wrong place at the wrong time. My mother's like, well, maybe we're at the right place at the wrong time, because we had a different opinion of what we were faced with, what it meant for the community, what it meant for us. And, of course, my mother was thinking at the time more in the direction of, what's going to happen next, whereas I'm just like looking at this thing in complete, I'm almost in shock.
Hmm.
But so when she was on Unsolved, she says, well, none of us were really hurt. The kids weren't hurt, and the actual incident itself, we weren't really hurt. The pain and the suffering and the hurdles and the unfair treatment came from a lot of the local people.
Yeah.
not the incident itself. And to touch on this again, if anything, it has brought a lot of us together, not really apart. Even though we made history because we divided people, I've got some better friends now than I've ever had. I mean, Kevin is one of my better friends today. I never would have met him if we hadn't been through this. Melanie and I get along fantastic. A lot of the kids I went to school with who I've lost touch with reach out to me now because they're they feel somewhat vindicated by, you know, where this is going, and that, hey, they've been able to somehow overcome it. You know, we've all been able to overcome it as a new family.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, Tom, and Kevin may agree with this as well, that I think when people go through such a life-changing experience, you tend to transcend the normal shackles of relationships, like you've referred to there a couple of times. It's like you know, if you know what I mean. It's essentially, you seem to be working on some kind of spiritual level. You're above the constraints of normal conversation. It's almost as if this shared experience has given you a deeper understanding on our place in the world and our relationships to the people around us.
Yeah, it does. And I'll tell you something else, too. I don't mean to take up too much time, because I know Kevin probably has a lot to add to this, too. But did you? I almost died in 2005. And just before my father died, I was actually hit by a tractor-trailer truck. And basically left for dead.
Nice.
And it was at that point that my father at the time came to visit me and had said that what we had seen and what we were a part of much closer to home than we realized, and that when the time was right, we were going to write this book and include a lot of the material that he had gotten back from the United Nations, our documents, prayers, and forms. And so while I was healing, I was actually writing about the book and the things that I recall, you know, back in the day. And to keep me occupied, because I was, you know, I had two broken ankles, a broken leg, a broken back, you know, I was a mess. And I wasn't going anywhere for a while. And this was kind of to take my mind off things. And I gave those writings to my father, who went back to Connecticut. And, you know, and he was discussing some of the pages and what we were going to do and why he felt it was the right time to do it. And then he went to his office, which was October 2nd, the same day that our case went before the United Nations, with a packet of the information that I wrote about September 1st. And his head hit the desk, and he was rushed to Yale New Haven Hospital, and he died. And so I'm still back at the house now with the loss of my father dying on the same day of this United Nations address, October 2nd. And I had already given him my papers. And so when, you know, the mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut, found this to be quite peculiar. He called in the CDC, and they came in and eventually condemned the building. They found ceiling tiles that were recently changed in his office with no work order for it. His laptop was wiped out. And so now I'm back in the house thinking to myself, my God, he was 54 years old. This is just not a coincidence. And so I decided that with the context that I had and you know, my brother was really driving us in the beginning, that, you know, we needed to bring, you know, reintroduce this case in a respectful way, to not so much to focus on the case, but to find out what happened to my father. That's how this got refueled. It was really about getting to the bottom of what happened, how my father died.
Yeah.
That too has been lost, you know, to the sensationalism. And so I do watch a show, whatever show it is. I don't want to, you know, whether it's on science or travel, whatever. And I look at these things, and my mother usually comes down and watches them with me. And we don't see any of the substance. And just like you said, the Phoenix Lights, all these people that, you know, that saw this thing in unison. You know, they saw this thing as groups and families and even strangers, and they're all watching this thing. Yet, right, they get picked on, or they're you know, discredited for some reason, or it was just this, or it was that, or and that's got to change. You know, so with Kevin's help and some other influential people that support us, and you know, we've got the governor, the lieutenant governor, historians, that kind of thing. I really do think that the Sheffield incident is going to make a significant mark, a good mark. You know, it's going to etch substance into this topic, because I'm not into profiting, I'm not selling books, I just think that it's about time that this nonsense stopped.
Yeah.
And people took a look at this case and took a look at everything that's involved in this. You know, grows up.
Yeah. Absolutely. It treats you with the respect you deserve, I think, more than anything. Tom?
If you want to use the word knocking, there is another gentleman that has tried to claim this as his, and his story is just kind of out of regular reality. It doesn't look real. They showed a lot of him in Unsolved Mysteries that I found very uncomfortable to me, because it's not what happened, but I like to make a joke about the person. He looks like somebody who had been left over from the 70s, still get some of that weed and lying on his back and look at the stars and think it's going to lift him up. That's kind of what this guy's tried to do, this story, and it's really, he's under, in other words, he's stained it, this gentleman, and Tom knows what I'm talking about, you know, and that's why the disrespect for what he has done to the story, and it's like people seem to want to make it now their story, and as Tom is saying, it's not just so much about Tom, and it's about a family that went through this and all the people in the community that saw it, and people like myself that have got involved because there were connections to it, and researching it makes it feel like my grandfather used to say, just because you can't prove what it is, it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
I think that often happens, though, Kevin, that there are numerous examples of that kind of situation where people try to insert themselves into events for whatever reason, whether it's to basically either for their own ego, or they want to feel important, or they wish to be considered different or special, if you know what I mean. And there are numerous examples of this throughout a lot of cases where all of a sudden somebody comes up and their version of events just doesn't fit in with everybody else's, because, as you refer to it, it's very clear from my opinion and from friends and family that I've spoken to, because, you know, I've got a base of friends and family around me. We all love this kind of situation. We love these kind of experiences, and people like yourself being brave enough, Tom, to come forward and be brutally honest and lay it all out there for us. For me, and I'm not saying I'm any kind of expert, but you can smell a rat when it turns up, when the story just it falls into this kind of it's over the top. It's too much, because Melanie's version, and I mean, you look at Jane. I mean, here we have an 85, 86 year old woman, bless her, who has absolutely nothing to gain. I mean, once again, you're in this, oh, she's only doing it for the money. Why on earth an 86 year old woman?
She didn't get any money.
Exactly. Why on earth would she want to put herself through this? You know, like she said, she hadn't said anything for years because she was embarrassed. She didn't want to.
She said that I liked, and she's a wonderful woman. And she said, even if I get Alzheimer's, I'll never forget that day. That tells you the woman's serious.
Oh, yeah, and she actually is the one who went see, I don't know if your listeners know this either, but Tom Jay was actually a ham radio operator. And the calls were actually coming in through ham radio. People were talking about what they saw on ham radio. Now, you got a picture, 1969 in the Berkshires didn't even have, like, an FM radio station. I mean, they didn't even have an FM radio station. You had an AM news station that got off the air at 5, and the only place you could hear music was in our diner. And so, with that said, Tom Jay was really just a news broadcaster, and so when the news went off at 5, he would go home, play with his ham radios, And all of a sudden, you know, he was hearing that they were noticing something in the sky. So he actually went back to WSBS and reopened that station and got on the air, because after 5 o'clock, everything was just on a reel-to-reel, you know, just played songs. And he got on the air and said, hey, guys, you know, I'm getting all these calls. Tell me where this is. Tell me what's going on. And Jan Green had just seen it and ran down to the station, was pounding on the door. I mean, she pounded on the door of WSBS Radio, which is still there today in the same building. And so it drove her to not just talk about it, but to get in her car and drive to the radio station.
Yeah.
And so that is moving, you know. And we used to know her back in the day. I used to, you know, that was the she owned a pharmacy. And in her pharmacy, she had like a coffee shop too. And so our family knew her family. My mother did. And there's no lying in her. That's the real deal right there. And my mother, again, she's 80, you know. She's Jan. You know, as far as staying alive, Tommy, I don't know what that was about. Then again, you've got some people that I don't know if they really added anything. But, you know, again, Kevin Titus definitely should have been in that episode. Just hands down, he should have been in that episode. There's no denying.
Quite a bit with it, too. The scene was very dramatic. It was me in a courtroom, and the documents were brought up to me, and I asked questions, are these real? Yes. And I signed them, and I'm wearing my judge's robe, and my wife was sitting there the whole 10 hours filming, and it was really good. I saw the replays. It was amazing. I just wish that they had done it. I was very annoyed that they did not show it, because it kills one of the most important parts that make this historically significant, where it can't be contested. They showed nothing.
I think it gives it more credence, and it gives it more gravitas, because at the end of the day, we're talking about legal documentation here. You know, we're not talking about somebody just writing a statement, are we? We're talking about a legally binding document that basically, as you said, once it's written, it's enshrined, it's there, it's done.
Do you find any similarities between this case and in Sheffield, England?
Well, it is very interesting, because I myself, Tom, have had a sighting 13 years ago. And when you were describing what you saw, I found it quite interesting, because what I saw was something that I cannot to this day explain. But I'm a rational man as well. So I'm one of those people that I will try to remove any doubt or any kind of confusion, because where I live, just down the road, we have an area called the Peak District, which has a long history of strange lights being seen over it. And this particular evening, I essentially saw a ball of fire drifting through the sky, very similar to like what you were saying, that when I first saw it, it just looked like a ball, and that's all I thought it was. And the more I looked at it, I suddenly realized it was like you could see the flames licking across it. You know when you see really blue flame?
Yeah.
Like it's white hot. And it was essentially like that. And I was fully aware of it. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was sat in my back room upstairs, and I was on the internet, and I'd got the radio on as I used to do just before I went to bed, just, you know, checking the news and being online as I used to do in those days. And it caught my eye, and it struck me. So at first I thought, well, maybe it's a reflection. So I turned all the lights off. I opened the window, shut the window, checked that it wasn't a street light bouncing off something in the room. I went through everything it could possibly be, and I watched it and thought, well, maybe it's a car headlight. I removed any shadow of doubt that it was a reflection, or it was light from somewhere else, or it was pollution, or it was a Chinese lantern, or anything. It was nothing of that regard, and I was completely perplexed, because I'm not going to pretend I'm an astronomer, or I know enough about science to be able to explain what I saw. But
correct,
I watched it for 30, 40 minutes, just drifting along, never wavered, didn't drop, didn't go up, didn't go down. It just stayed on a constant path, and I watched it until it disappeared out of my eyesight. And I was so convinced that I must have seen, I thought the only thing it could possibly would be some kind of comet or meteor. So I contacted the British Astronomical Society and I basically said, I think I've seen a comet over Sheffield, and I gave them all the details and everything, and they came back and said, it's not anything like that because it was too slow. And to this day, I cannot explain what it was. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it was definitely a UFO. All I know is I saw an object in the sky that I cannot explain. Simple as that.
Would you like to hear more of what sightings people have seen in Sheffield?
I'd love to hear the other relevance, because I think the other aspect of this as well, Tom, is this isn't a one-off. This area that we're talking about, where you are, has a history of this, doesn't it?
It has not stopped. I mean, I guess it was about 1974. A lot of children were near a park, which is near Dewey School, which is now the Great Barrington Courthouse. There was a field that kids would slide on. It had a little steep hill, and it would level off, and there was a picnic bench up there, so in the wintertime the kids would bring their sleds and that kind of thing. Well, a bunch of us. I mean, there was probably, it wasn't far from the school, so there was maybe 30, 40 children in the park. Mm. And this orange ball, like you said, and what was seen in Sheffield, that was a self-contained ball of orangey, multicolors, not just orange, but like different tones of orange, you know, like a darker orange, lighter, and almost like a sun, like the sun is, you know, right there in front of you.
Yeah.
It was coming towards the park at a great rate of speed, and when it got to the park, slowed down, took a 90-degree turn, and maintained the same distance off the ground, shot down the park, raised itself up over houses, and dived into the woods. And all these kids went running into the woods. Another time we had, or what was seen by many, was what looked like a cigar-shaped object in the sky. Mm. And cars were pulled off on the side of the road, all looking at this thing. And then all of a sudden, bang, like that, it was gone. And it was huge. And then there was this, again, an orange, no, white sphere of light, like again, a self-contained white ball. And people were staring at this thing and then realized, thinking it was the moon, and then looked over here and realized it wasn't the moon. And then this thing just shot to the ground in like a second's time. No trail of light, and then just stopped above the ground. That was in around the early 80s, mid 80s, around the time of the Hudson River Valley sightings.
Yeah.
So those are just, I mean, there were many others. There were some in, in September of 1969, there were four golfers at a country club that reported the sightings, and it was given a classification by J. Allen Hynek, and it was CE1, I guess it was the classification it got. And then, of course, again, I keep going back to what's happening recently with the crop circles, because they have made national news about the crop circles, not 1 year, but 2 years. Mm. And what's interesting, this is not in a field, it's in a cornfield. And the corn is burned. You know, you can actually see where it's charred, where like something with heat. It almost looks like something, what would you say, Kevin, more like a landing area or more like a crop circle?
Yeah, I would say more like a landing area.
Mm.
Because the way to learn the pattern, it was very unusual. And nothing will, like I said, will grow there at all on those spots. And they tried, nothing.
Yeah, so that, yeah, some of that's on my page as well. But I guess where I'm going with this, this town of Sheffield, in the United States, is plagued with activity.
Hmm.
And if you walk down that road, like Kevin was mentioned earlier, where it still bothers me, if whether you're aware of what happened there or you're not, so many people feel bothered, feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like there's an undertow there, something not right.
Mm.
And I even feel that, but it's more heightened for me because I have this bizarre type of or uncomfortable, you know, physical or emotional memory.
Yeah.
And I use that or reference, you know, that feeling, you know, to my childhood. And whereas a lot of other people that have no idea that, because some people go through that park and they, you know, they don't know what to expect, you know, they don't really realize what it is. Mm. And they will say, you know, man, I don't feel right. I don't like it here. You know, I'm uncomfortable. There's like this eerie undertow.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know why this is. You know, is it possible that something's underground there that's putting off an electromagnetic field, or is there actually, you know, some kind of a base under there? It's almost like there's a bleed of energy,
yeah,
that your body picks up on. I think, didn't you have somebody go there with a meter, Kevin, at one point back in the day?
Yeah, about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, we went there with one of those, you know, those little radioactive kind of meters, you know, the old ones that you saw in the Cold War. And he had one that worked, and he took it over there, and he put it over the soil, and it went crazy. And then you would go off to another side, and there was nothing. It was perfectly normal. Now, and when you go through the giant stalks, like I always have to bring this, because my sister-in-law, my wife's family, is one of those that are very hard to convince about anything.
Yes.
And when we took her through there, she got self-convinced, because she had never seen stalks of corn that big, never saw burn marks, anything like it, never felt sick anywhere. She was very uncomfortable standing there, especially walking down the road by the telephone pole where Tom's car stopped.
Mm.
And she said that I didn't want to go in further because, I don't know about you, but they have these spiders are huge. It reminds me of something that's been mutated down there. They're huge. She saw that's all she needed. And, of course, we pulled off the samples of the corn that Tom and I have photographed. My wife's holding one, and I tell you what, it's huge. I've never seen anything. And the next, we put it in the refrigerator because I love corn. I thought, hey, you know, the next day I'm going to cook me some nice corn from the field. It turned all black. You want to eat that?
Now, how about this, right? Here's something else that even gets more bizarre. Again, I don't talk about this so much, but hey, I might as well. do you remember about the stuff that was glowing in the park, Kevin?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Were you there that day?
Yeah. I was there. I think you're talking with some kind of weird, like a kind of wind picking up the stuff or something.
So there was, about five or six of us, and we had met with a good friend of mine to bring them to the park and show them what was, the progress and the sponsors and that kind of thing. And we were walking down the dirt road. This is probably right where it happened, probably around 10 o'clock at night. And we all started feeling kind of odd. And I think it was Sean Payne Stowe. I was there, Paul, a bunch of us. And we started to walk into the cornfield. And these areas where nothing grows. And we were in off the road maybe, 20, 30 feet. And all of a sudden, Paul felt really sick. He had to kind of leave. And as he's leaving, he noticed that his sneakers were glowing, almost like someone had a black light in the area.
Mm.
And were you there? You were there, right, for that? And I look at my
sneakers.
I'm like looking at my sneakers, and I'm like looking at my clothes. And it really was like there was a black light. You know how black, you know, makes everything glow. And we all started just standing in this area where nothing grows, and we're noticing at like 10 o'clock at night that anything white was actually, in some respects, actually glowing. It wasn't like a white light, like the moon was lighting up or someone had a flashlight on you. It was the strangest thing, and we all left. It's bizarre because these are, again, this wasn't something that just happened to one person. We don't know what that was. We don't have any idea why, why that could even possibly happen.
Yeah.
But But again, we don't talk about these things much because too much is not good, right? I mean, you've got, it's like enough already. It's like, but we stick to 1969.
It's a very unusual area. And when Tom walks it, every time I've seen Tom walk down that little dirt road, it's the same as it was in 69, a few potholes and all that. But when Tom goes down, he goes down to almost, he'll go almost halfway down, and all of a sudden you'll come to that telephone pole, and Tom starts saying things like, you know, I really don't feel very good right now. I'm very uncomfortable. Mm. It happens automatically as soon as Tom goes there. As soon as he walks away and gets back into the part of the park, he's okay. Yeah. It's really weird.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, other people feel it too. And so we thought because a telephone pole was there, maybe the telephone pole had a transformer on it, right? Maybe there was something that was making it feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But there's nothing on it.
Yeah.
And there's not even power out there. There isn't electricity out there. It's just a phone line. And and so we thought, well, that would explain it, because I'm like you, sir. I'm like, there's got to be an explanation. You know, I'm always looking for, well, I know what it's not. You know,
yes.
And once I get my list of what it's not, then it can only be one thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying, okay, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this. And you're left with, well, what is it then? And there's an awful lot of what is it thens that happen in Sheffield, Massachusetts.
Absolutely. Well, listen, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your conversation this evening. It's been wonderful to speak to you both. Listen, where can everybody keep up to date and keep their eye on everything that's going on with you both? Tom, can you give us your links and where people can keep up to date with what's going on with the UFO park and yourself?
Yeah, the park, UFOpark.org, UFOpark.org, and of course, Berkshiresufo.com is my site as well, Berkshiresufo.com, and we'll have a lot of updates. There's also behind the scenes of the filming of it, and the government's letters are on that site as well.
Excellent. Well, listen, thank you, and thank you, Kevin. It's been brilliant to have your input as well this evening. Greatly appreciate you both. I want to just say thank you again, and I wish you all the very best. Whatever's going on, please keep me informed, and I look forward to finding out more about this particular area, and thank you again for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome. Good evening.